This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about identity with such a multi-hyphenate person that I don't even know what to list. This is someone that, to me, is a comedian, a clown, a writer, and really my kind of intellectual, you know, someone that has opinions and thoughts that are very their own, which I love. I love it when I can tell that somebody's perspective is so honed through their lived experience versus, like, you know, we can all be guilty at times of inheriting a lot of things. And today's guest, Elf Lyons, is someone that I think you only need to listen to a few minutes of this conversation to know that she questions everything and thinks through everything. And it's fascinating to hear the thoughts that she's come up with through that. I know that sounds very vague and thoughtsy, but you'll understand why when we get into this conversation. Elf has a level of existentialism and ability to analyze everything right down to, I have a thought on that last word that I said that I think you'll recognize as being kind of similar to me in certain ways. And so it was no surprise that we got into it and we just went with the conversation and chatted. And if she didn't have a gig to run off to straight after this recording, we could have gone for hours. We would have just kept going. And we kind of did with the bit behind the paywall. We just kind of continued the conversation because we both had more that we wanted to share and wanted to pack in, but we were running out of time, so we needed to wrap up the main episode. So a lot explored in terms of identity and how it relates to mental health. We talk about social media, we talk about boundaries, we talk about work and how that impacts your identity. We talk about finding balance. And, you know, that is a wonderful kind of upswing for her of finding new ways to reestablish balance in her life. Also, as a side note, Elf was previously a guest on Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast, the other show that I host, and ended up being one of the most loved guests who I still get lovely messages about today, particularly to do with the dating story that she shared, which involved scaling Millennium Dome. And that's all the teaser I'm going to give on it. So I'll link that episode in the description for this one. And I also very much plan, we may have even talked about it on air, I now can't remember if it was on air or off. I very much hope to get her back on that show again. So might as well get ahead of it. Go listen to her first appearance and be ready for her second. For now, let's get into this conversation with Elf and let the elfing begin. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Elf Lyons, Bobby. Hello, listeners. It's so interesting reflecting on mental health. I remember this idea, especially growing up in a female-centered environment, because I went to a boarding school. All the films, all the TV shows, all the literature about women, women's sort of value or their attractiveness often was laid down by how disturbed they were. I always remember that being a thing. Like the girl, the attractive dream character in a drama had anorexia, or they came from a troubled home, or they were aggressive, or they were violent. There was always this focus on they were extreme in some way. And I remember there was this sort of mystery held around girls at my school about what issues you had. And there was a certain, I suppose, underlying taboo coolness. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure people recognize that. Or, you know, the way someone who had an eating disorder, there was this sort of weird, especially what you watch Skins now, and the way Cassie is sort of sexualized and made attractive in it and like manic pixie dream girl. And her main defining characteristic is the fact that she's very unwell. I didn't realize I had really extreme obsessive compulsive disorder. And when I say extreme, I mean, when I was a kid growing up, at primary school at my mum and dad's house, everyone sort of, you know, laugh at my eccentricities. I was obsessed with checking things. I was very, very frightened, very stranger danger related. So I'd check under my bed, I'd open up cupboards, I'd switch the lights on and off. I had to make sure there were no sharp edges or corners in a room. And when I was little, you could sort of put that down to, you know, oh, just being little overactive imagination. And when I went to boarding school and I was suddenly in an environment where I was with 12 other girls in a dormitory and I didn't have control over the space, over the corners, over the rooms, over the doors being opened and closed, I was very frightened that something bad was going to happen. And I thought if I didn't double check the cupboard, there was probably going to be a man hiding in there ready to attack me. I was really cripplingly anxious. And I used to have this fear about going to the toilet, so much so that I would go to this loo about 12 times in the space of half an hour before bedtime. And I wouldn't drink any water like the hours leading up to bed because I didn't want to have to need the loo in the middle of the night. And I'd wake up always at about 3 a.m, desperate for the loo. And I was like, is this paranoia? Is this really? And I ended up waking up other girls to walk with me, just like it was just across the hall, waking them up to walk me to the loo because I was so frightened. And eventually, it sounds quite dark. I mean, it is probably kid, and I probably an advertisement as to why boarding schools are inherently not a great place. But a girl, and she has apologized since, she once, because she thought it was funny, she removed all the light bulbs from all the little side lights in our room. So I tried to do my checks and I couldn't. And I had a full on breakdown. I must have been about 12. And at that moment, the teachers went, well, we think there's something a bit wrong here. So I got sent to a psychiatrist and a counsellor. And I saw that psychiatrist to do with my obsessive compulsive disorder. And in hindsight, I don't know how much it helped. But I suppose just having someone listen for that period of time and the fact that there was someone's job to listen sort of validated my experience and made me think maybe I wasn't alone. But yeah, that was my first introduction to, I suppose, feeling like I was strange and other, or the thing that I did was a bit weird. Mm-hmm. So that was my first proper understanding of mental illness.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I relate to a lot of that. In particular, I want to call back briefly what you mentioned about Cassie, because I had such an obsession with skins when I was younger. And it's only in hindsight that I can see that that was one of the few bits of representation of mental illness that I had in my young life. And that's where a lot of the relatability is. And Cassie in particular, you know, I related to her profoundly whilst also being ignorant of having an eating disorder myself. And it did feel at the time like I really fancied her. And it's interesting what you said about her being like sexualized, because that's probably part of the key to it, that I was encouraged to, like, that was part of her narrative, that she was beautiful and troubled and needed saving but also couldn't be helped. And that kind of like conundrum that was both intriguing but also relatable for me. And so, yeah, no, it's good to hear you sort of picked up on that too, because yeah, I look back on it now and I don't know if I did fancy her or I was just like in awe of someone that seemed to be going through things that I could relate to, even if I wasn't facing up to them yet. And you also mentioned there how often there is this fascination in women that are struggling with their mental health. And it's such a kind of two-sided thing, right? That they're either to be stared at and contemplated and figured out, or they're to be kind of cast off and belittled. Mm-hmm. You know, you're either troubled and fascinating or you're crazy and invalid.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I was thinking about this with Mean Girls. Do you know, like, the two friends, the sort of queer, the two queer, like, the gay best friend, mm-hmm. and then, like, the angry lesbian, you know, those were the sort of the two stereotypes. But she's got all this rage in her, and we sort of forget that rage is also excessive rage and anger and frustration. That is another sign of, you know, those are the struggles of mental illness to an extent. And the way she's presented as being this comedic, like, the mania, I think that's it. They present mania, these manic characters in films are always really funny and to be laughed at and scorned because it's so there. It's so in your face. It's so like, this is me. this is my mental health issue that you should, that I want someone to pay attention to, and they become the comedic character, whilst you then got the sort of the submissive mental health issue, the behind closed doors, and no, you, I can't be fixed, and there's nothing you can do, and I will die young, but I'm so honourable in the quietness in which it's so held in this old traditional idea of women's place in society.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm just going to pick up my cat because she is being needy, because she's, I think she resonates with this conversation that we are
she's
having.
Like, what, we're talking about women's place in the home? Well, mine is on your lap 24/7.
I mean, I've been reading this book called Polysecure about different attachment styles, like anxious, avoidant, all this sort
I'm
of stuff.
Really, I've
never. Oh, it's great, isn't it? It's really fantastic. And I'm learning that my cat is very much just, she's just pure attachment.
She's like, she's all of them.
You just can't, she can't cope. And she's already jealous that I'm doing something that doesn't involve her and running around the house with a mouse. I'm not sure if I explained the idea eloquently enough about the idea of the two different styles of mental health.
No, I think you did, because I think it is an extension of the stigma that there's this weird paradox that can be disproportionately put on women of, you are to be encouraged to like talk about your mental health, and in not doing so or pushing down things, as the stigma encourages you, there's a strange intrigue there. But if you do open up and you do proactively tell people when you're struggling, then that might be a bit much.
Yeah. It's like, you know, in 10 Things I Hate About, actually Mean Girls takes the mick out of it as well. There's a moment in Mean Girls where that woman comes on stage and she just talks about her feelings and everyone's like, who are you? And she's like, I've just got a lot of feelings. And the joke is at the expense of someone sharing who they are. And the character is funny. But at the same time, it also does make a comment about our reaction, especially about our tongue, to people being vocal about how what's going on mentally. And I was thinking, 10 Things I Hate About You, I suppose, is another good example of Julia Stiles' character, the angry woman, the angry, grief-stricken as well, dealing with the grief of the death of her mother, if we're being really seriously analysing that film. But she's parodied, she's taken the mick out for having all this rage and being really, like, out there. Not saying that that character has mental health illnesses at all, but there is something really fascinating about how she's presented and then how her sister is presented.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that which character then needs to be changed.
Yeah, well, that contrast is used for like the dramatic effect. But this is the thing, that so often the drama is put before the humanity and the reality of representation. Like I'm saying all mm-hmm. the time, you know, I would really love to just someday see a character that experiences mental ill health, and it's not a plot line. You know, maybe they mm-hmm. take a pill every day. Maybe they go to therapy and it's just, that's it. They just leave a scene by going off to therapy and they come back in a later scene. And we don't have to like make the therapist part of the plot, or we don't have to have a reaction to the drugs, or their struggle doesn't have to be the most interesting thing about them.
And can we stop making therapists and films either really creepy? Therapists are always so creepy, or they're very, very, there's something going on. Like even in Skins, the therapist is a serial killer who kills Cook, I yeah. think his name was. Therapists are always presented as being these non-trustworthy characters, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, well, I think that reflects still a lot of like societal perceptions, particularly, you know, in the time when what we're discussing, you know, programs we were discussing there were made. And yeah, I agree. I also have like a, you know, a smaller qualm with a lot of it, where I just think the therapists talk too much. Just stop giving them so many lines. It's not realistic.
Yeah, they talk a lot. My therapist is phenomenal. They're very fashionable. And I don't know anything about them, because I'm like, how are you? And then they're like, good, how are you? You know, it's always back to me. And I'm so like, I said this to them, I'm trying to keep it neutral so there's no giveaway of, you know, gender, name, etc. But I said to them, I was like, it's bizarre. I've known you. You've been in my life for nearly 6 years. I said, but, and I do find it fascinating, the relationship, the trust I have for you and the safety I feel in this space, without knowing anything about you. And I was in my And there's this desire to know, but also this respect that I shouldn't. I was in town the other day, I said the other day, about a month ago, and I walked past this very cool pub, which I'm yet to go to, and everyone looks so fashionable in there. And I've never had an excuse. And I walked past and I suddenly saw them in the pub with a group of friends. I have no idea that they're... I was like, do they live in my area? Are they visiting? And their head turned towards the window, the glass, and I just dropped to the floor because I thought, I don't want them to see me here. I don't want them to know that I saw them here, because then they'll think, oh, my elf lions is stalking me. I suddenly got really paranoid that I didn't want to impede on their night. It's like seeing a teacher outside of, like, seeing the teacher in the supermarket. And going, oh my God.
Yeah, they don't have friends. They don't exist outside of this building.
I think my I just finished being a teacher. I feel like a lot of my ex-students must think that I don't have any friends, because when I see them outside of school and they're walking down the street or in the area and I pass them, like, I naturally will say hello. But I think I'm always so happy to see them. Like, I'm always like, hello, how are you? And I think they must think, goodness, Miss Lyons doesn't have anyone to talk to. She's so happy to ask me how school's going.
Of course you're going to have an interest and then you're going to get on with your day.
They're kids. They're cute. I just want to make sure that they're doing all right. I'm like, I'm so proud of you. I miss teaching you. And they're like, all right, miss, have a good day.
Oh, but circle back to the stuff about therapists. It's, you know, there's different approaches, right, in terms of, like, how you handle the ethics around, like, self-disclosure. And I'm in the same place with, I am not going to therapy currently, but with my most recent counsellor, you know, I had that same thing of, I wanted to know things, but I wasn't going to ask, you know, I was going to be respectful. And, you know, that was part of the modality that I was dealing with, was this kind of person that's a reflective character in my life that is there as a consistent person, but that consistency does not extend to kind of mutual disclosures. And I remember at one point she mentioned something about parenting that was, like, so insightful that I just kind of picked up from it that she must be a parent, and I'd never known. And it just was one of those little mind-blowing moments of, like, I've never known anyone for 4 years and not known they were a parent. Like, that's such a massive part of someone's life. And it also felt like a strange victory to, like, catch that insight. And, you know, and she like, I think I asked her then, because I was like, oh, it feels like we're already here. And she did say that, yeah, she has 2 kids, and then moved the conversation on. And it's, yeah, I don't ask her about the kids, but it was something that I was like, ooh.
It's also what I love about it is that complete respect we have for someone else's privacy, which we've lost in so many aspects of society. Because the truth is, it's so easy to find out about anyone. Like, and really also for most therapists, if you type their name in, you'll often find a paper or them being referenced. If they've written an article on mental health or, you know, whatever it is their area of expertise is in. A student said, I saw you on the internet. And I said, oh, okay, why was it by accident? They went, no, I searched for you. And I said, why would you do that? You know, and it wasn't a criticism. I was like, why would you do that? And they didn't really have an answer. And I said, imagine if I searched for you. And they all laugh because they're like, well, that would be weird. And I'm like, exactly. Why is it okay for you to do that to me? And some of the students, when they found out I was a comedian, you have to immediately go to a senior teacher and explain and be like, just to let you know. And the kid has to get spoken to, because that new generation especially don't understand the fact that it's not everyone's right to know something about everyone else. I remember, like, the days when Facebook first came out and how annoyed I'd be. There'd be, like, a crush and you'd type their name in and then their profile would be unlimited, so I couldn't see if they were in a relationship. And I used to be like, oh, no. Because we were just kids and we didn't have any, you know, it was such an exciting new revelation. Now it's more... When you see that someone's profile's unlimited or private, you're like, wow, that's so much more. I love it. I don't know who they are. You know, because we were so used to everything being readily available to everyone else. To clarify, I don't go around stalking people on the internet. But, you know, and you're so, oh, well, that's a person.
No, it's true, though. That is such a, like, a journey that we go through, though, isn't it? That you kind of start off with that access to information and it then feels like a violation. It's not, but it feels like a violation to not have access to information about somebody that, particularly if it's someone like you're young and you have a crush on, or like a new friend and you feel like, you know, it's perfectly innocent to want to find out loads about them in your head. And yeah, we don't have those ideas of boundaries. And then you get a bit older and then you're like, oh, aren't they mysterious having a private profile? Like, we then go the other way, that we then like project our feelings on their boundaries as something to do with us. And it's none of their page was ever to do with us.
I think this is something about like identity and who we are and the effect internet has on our personalities. I find it really interesting how I regularly delete Instagram and then reinstall it onto my phone because I use it for comedy, but my comedy persona. And it's really fascinating how I reflect how much it impacts me mentally, because I noticed if I don't put pictures of myself will get far more interaction than a picture of something that I like. If I put a picture of myself or a full body picture, my ticket sales will increase. If I put a picture up of something I think is funny, no, doesn't. And that tells you a lot subconsciously about how you're valued or your audience, and that subconsciously it makes me go, well, I need to put these particular pictures online in order to get my audience, et cetera, et cetera. And that's complex. And how much do I really want to give? Some comedians, some performers, some artists, their identity, their family, their children, their relationships are part and parcel of their product. And I don't want that to be me, because I think that would really disturb me mentally, because I know my own history to mental health and addiction and depression and OCD. I've got quite an addictive personality, and I have to be really aware of. There was a period of time when I had a proper eating disorder around about 2018, and I was doing Chiff Chaff, and I was putting loads of pictures of myself in my underwear because I looked very thin, and I was doing loads of hula hooping, and I was doing this show, and everyone was like commenting, and I was getting so much interaction on my Instagram. And so I got a little bit obsessive it comes up on your archive. I was putting a picture of myself in like my swimming costume in the gym like every day. And it wasn't sexy, but it was. I was like, what's this doing to my, how? And if I didn't get all the likes or the Instagram, like, you know, the flame emoji, I would sort of go into a bit of a spiral. It was terrible. And now I look back on that and I feel so much pain going, who is it, a comedian? Is it me? Am I the artist? Am I Emily Ann? Am I Elf? Who is this? And now I've got my Elf Lines profile, which is purely persona, comedy persona. And I occasionally share vulnerable things, but it's with regard of who is my audience, you know, mental health, things that matter to me, I will share. And then I've got my own personal profile, which is literally all the things that only about 50 friends follow me on that. And it's, you know, pictures of guinea pigs and books and the sky. And then there's other things, other forums that I have, which are another part of me.
Yeah, it's such a complicated thing to navigate. And I think it's something that, you know, particularly people younger than us are kind of encouraged, whether it's kind of vocally by people in their life or sort of subtly via algorithms, to turn themselves into products. In one way, you have the work in order to justify it of, okay, it's really fucking weird that I have to like constantly post my face because that's what gets the clicks and that's what seems to drive sales. But at least it's with, you know, the ambition of driving sales, and I get to create some separation by having this be my work persona. You know, this is my work account that I do, you know, and then if it's exhausting posting on it, well, it's work, it's exhausting, versus like feeling you have to do that in your personal life, like a lot of people feel, you know. And that terrifies me, the idea of like, it's very impressive to me when other people can do it and have very entertaining like stories every day, but I find that to be so much pressure, the idea of like documenting my day and finding it funny and taking on the feedback of how many likes I'm getting and altering how I film myself in different camera angles to get more likes. And yeah, for me, I think there would be a danger there, mental health wise, and yeah, including eating disorder wise, if I went too far down, you know.
I think there's so much people don't, I wonder, I think our generation, especially our generation, if now as our generation have kids, etc., and we live in a world where everyone has had Facebook, everyone's had Twitter, everyone's had Instagram. the dialogue and the PSHE classes. And rather than those patronising safety on the internet lectures that have been made by people who didn't grow up with the internet and aren't obsessed with it the way our generation is, I think the interaction and the health advice will be so much more nuanced. The way I see it, and it's interesting, especially when you're, you know, because the majority of my work is to do with me, is finding a, you know, Google Translate, you put a language in and then you translate, hello, I am Elf Lyons, blah, I like sausages, translate that to French, and then it says it in French, and then you translate it back into English, and it's slightly different. It's the same, but it doesn't quite mean the same. That's how I try and live all my online interactions. You get me, you get a side of me, but you don't actually get, I've carefully chosen what you are seeing. That doesn't mean I'm not being honest, but I'm safeguarding myself. And
I love
that. A lot of art, pardon?
No, I really love that. Like the illusion of access, like it's creating a boundary, but it's a boundary that like is only observable from your perspective. It's a very impressive way of approaching it.
But I wonder, like, I was thinking about this. I was at an event the other day and there some cam girls were there and we were all talking about, you know, sex work and sex positivity and being openly sluts. That was sort of the discussion about sex positivity and being happy and being slut and what does a slut mean. And I was chatting to some people about, you know, there's this idea that you see someone in their underwear online, you're like, I know everything about them. You're like, no, actually, the things that you're not seeing, them with their dog, them in their tracksuit bottoms, them just chilling out in their house, that is the person. You're seeing, again, their product, what they need from you in order to exist and live. Just because somebody's sans clothes does not mean you've seen them, does not mean they've become vulnerable.
Yeah, and I think this is where it kind of goes both ways of we're having more and more conversations around, you know, what somebody does for work, in particularly in conversations around sex work, does not equate to value. You know, these conversations are happening more and more in the same way it doesn't equate to how much access you should have to somebody just because they share more things online than you might do. And on the flip side of that, you know, I think it's important to remember, like, what is the value of this kind of algorithmic feedback that we have? Because, like, I love that example of, like, you post pictures of yourself versus things you find interesting. And even though one might actually say more about you and who you are than the other, it's the pictures of you that get the likes. And a lot of that, to me anyway, is down to things like familiarity bias, that people scroll through and they see that comedian they like, that person they recognize, maybe it's your friend seeing a picture of you as well, and they like it because it's an easy like. It's like, oh, there's Elf, she looks great, or I recognize her. Like, it's very automated, and that doesn't necessarily actually have that much to do with the value of that content. You know, it's more to do with other people's psychology and other people's ease of scrolling than it is the value of that photo shoot or the value of your work.
Absolutely. This is the thing. I had to remind myself of this. So, like, I put a picture up of me when I was in hospital, 2018, really, and I was really sick. That's an incredibly vulnerable picture. I'm not naked in that. It's very, very vulnerable. And that's me being really honest in the picture and the statement underneath it. Or I was talking at the time how I'd just been told by the doctors I might not be able to walk again. Like, I'm really sharing to people who follow me on Instagram, strangers and friends, I'm in a really dark place. And nobody in my family will comment on it. You know, they'll like it and support it, but nobody raises any qualms about that. And then I put a picture of me basically in my underwear, being really, like, sex positive, being like, I'm a sassy lady, blah, 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 jiggle, jiggle. I don't know. But it was a saucy picture. And my brother was like, why have you put this up? And I naturally get really defensive. I'm like, you can't censor me, da 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 da. And he's like, it's not that. He's like, you can control how you choose, but you can't control how people take that picture. And I can get his panic because he's being a little brother. He's, you know, seeing his big sister also presenting herself in a sexual way. Any sibling's going to probably find that a bit, oh, God, why are you being like that? It's so embarrassing. So I do get it from that angle. And siblings are meant to get annoyed at you for anything that you do. But I did have to remind myself at the same time of going, okay, I do get some followers who I don't like, who write horrible comments. And that horrible reality of going, I might have been vulnerable in the other picture, but then no one's going to really sexualize me over that picture. I don't know how people are going to react to that picture that I've just put up. And then the problem is people behave terribly on the internet. And then I get hot. And when I have put saucy pictures up, and you know, they are there to show, you know, for me to be like, look at me, you know, I feel great. And then I get these horrible messages, which make me feel awful. And then I feel like a dirty person for putting the pictures up in the first place. And then I delete them. And then I'm like, I can't believe this guy has caused me to have to delete that picture. Oh, it just sends this downward spiral. And I still don't know how to work through that. I find that still quite complex.
Yeah.
Which is why it's so good to have friends that I can just happily send nudes to. I'm like, I feel really saucy. I don't want to put this picture on the internet, because that horrible weird guy will send me a weird picture or whatever. So can I have your consent to send a nude of myself or a picture of me in my underwear to you, and you can just text back and tell me I look fabulous? My friends are like, yeah, go for it.
I love that. You know, maybe that is one of the answers, because I don't, you know, I certainly don't think I found the answers for me. A lot of it has just been not posting. And honestly, that's a big part of why I love podcasting. That's not necessarily why I came to the medium, but there is such a comfort I found in not being observed in this. Mm. You know, people will comment on your voice or kind of make assumptions about you because they can't see you. But I'd much rather like that stuff, because that stuff's kind of, yeah, it feels less intimate to me, which is, your voice is kind of says just as much about you as your body does potentially, but it's to do with like the different boundaries that we all have. And I also find a lot of the assumptions really fun. Like I try and see so much of this public interaction through the lens of other people's psychology, because so often, you know, a horrible comment, as we know, says so much more about them than it ever says about you. And so like one of the fun ones I get with podcasting is people often assume I'm similar in age and or appearance to them if they relate to my work. And then they maybe meet me in real life and they're surprised that we're not as similar as they assumed. And it's because we assume, you know, familiarity equates to similarity, or relating to what somebody says equates to being a similar human through the narrow boxes of like age, appearance, hair color, whatever else.
Mm-hmm. I think there's something, I always make this point as well about, I can't listen to myself back on podcasts, because I always naturally, I'm so horrible to myself, and I listen back and I'm really, really critical. And I'm like, why didn't I, because you re-listen back and I'll be like, bollocks, Bobby said something amazing then. Why didn't I react to that? Why did I suddenly go back to this? Oh my goodness, I sound so self-involved and I'll go into this horrible place. And so I can't, I once we record this, I shall never listen. But I'm always aware people will listen to my voice and they might immediately go, I don't like this person. They're very posh. This person and I will have nothing in common. And you will hear it all, you see it all the time, people making immediate assumptions on what someone's struggle or life experience has been based on appearance, based on looks, based on voice. And I think in the UK, we're really, because we're so class focused and class obsessed and class critical, and also really misinformed as well, like, you know, the long-standing stereotypes that if you're from the north, you're working class, and if you're from the south, you're posh. And all these, like, really harrowingly horrible stereotypes that just impact everyone. It means we don't ever really listen and take on board sometimes when someone is saying something that resonates or actually could really help us. Because people go, well, they have a totally different life experience to me. How could that possibly be of use?
Yeah.
And it's really, really integral that we try and put that aside. So I don't know, with podcasts, I think in general, I'm much better in person, because in my body and in my face and body language, like, I communicate so much more visually. I think I probably come across much less likable in podcast than I do in real life, because I think I sound, you know, I sound a particular way, but, and then you see me and then you're like, oh no, she is like quite a long, floppy friendly sort of drop dead Fred type person. She doesn't seem as irritating as she says.
See, now you're projecting onto my audience that they've already turned on you, and I don't think they have.
No, your audience are probably lovely. I've just had some experiences.
I get where you're coming from, and you're spot on, I think, about the class thing. You know, that's something that I didn't know until recently, that my parents told me they they really made the decision to shield me from when they were, you know, bringing me up in the UK, that they were like, Irish people don't fit into the British class system. We're not meant to. We don't belong in that distinctly British thing. But equally, in a different kind of way, nobody does, because it's not a science. It doesn't actually add up. There's no rules that hold up in court about the class system making sense. And so a lot of the time people are driven by these very strange assumptions that you've described that don't actually help us understand each other or connect or do anything kind of productive in terms of like bettering our situation. And yet sometimes people can still have that internalized idea of, oh, I've got to play my part in this, because rising through the ranks of this stuff is how I survive in this country, rather than look for a way where the country can be more survivable for everyone.
You know, I just apply it to like when you see Twitter or Facebook threads where people suddenly just attack someone or get really angry. I'm always like, just ask an open-ended question and assume. I always think it's always best to assume what someone has said and what you consider to be malice could come from an accident. I always assume that someone hasn't intentionally aimed to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm working out what battle are we picking? I always do this like in the playground. Kids will come up to me and they'll be like, Miss, so-and-so did this, so-and-so. And I said, okay. And then you get the two kids together and you're like, so what happened? And then they explain and we go, and I go, okay. So it seems like A, I did this to B and B did this to C. And then C said this to A. Okay, so everyone has behaved like this. Did we intend to be cruel? And the kids will be like, no. Okay, right. So it wasn't malicious. That's really teacherly. Mm-hmm. But most interactions in the human world are, I do think, just come from a place of not thinking things through. They're not malicious. They're not spiteful. I'm ethically non-monogamous, and as experienced as I am in that, God, you know, it's a constant conversation and constantly sometimes that, you know, there'll be a, you know, misreading of a situation. You can't beat each other up about it. You can't belittle, you can't be nasty to yourself. You've got to be kind to yourself rather than being like, oh, I'm spiteful, I'm shit, I'm this, I'm that. Just going, okay, we just made a, you know, you change the behavior, you don't change the person.
No, I think you're spot on. And that's every other conversation I observe now on Twitter, is somebody tweeting something that maybe is funny or maybe is political. And then there's all these comments under it of, well, you're basically saying this is this. You're implying such and such. And the other person being like, but did I say that? Or you haven't considered this group of people. Did I reference them? Like, it's so strange, this kind of assumed narrative. Like, you said one thing and therefore you didn't, you also mean this. And it's like, no, I just meant what I said, and it was maybe actually a funny tweet. That's what it meant.
So, like, I'm aware that we had a big issue with school. My mental health has improved so much since leaving teaching. And it was the reason I actually put my notice in. I said, look, I love teaching. I really did. But I have a premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So I get really, like, my periods are, I go, you know, volatile. I find it really hard in the run up to my periods. Like, the change in my hormones is massive. And I found, and I'm a very sexual person and I love my sexuality as an artist and nudity in my body. And then I had a totally different persona at school and my clothes were different. And all my interactions, all the day-to-day, were chatting to kids. And so I'm a totally different adult, very serious. And the things I was picking up from the children, you know, and you're safeguarding constantly. And then I come home exhausted at about 6 p.m. And my identity, the person I've taken a long time learning to love, this eccentric weirdo, I was depleted. And my weekends, I just had no energy to dress up and go out and be the sensual version of myself. I would just want to stay in bed because I was so tired. And then trying to also be an artist on top of that, it was so exhausting. Like, it was just, I couldn't cope. I started to lose who I was and I felt years older than I am, and not in a good way. And I started to feel bitter and I didn't want that to ever come out in front of the students. And, you know, there were times I lost my temper and times maybe I was too hard on a kid. And I thought, I don't want that to happen. This isn't, and I went on fluoxetine and mental health pills, and nothing was helping. So eventually I just said, I went to the head of school. And I was
Eton,
like, look,
was that
I
where love... you were working?
Yeah, I was, yeah. So the children I was teaching, it was actually the House of Commons. A lot of bullying. Not on the kind. Boris stole my pencil case. Okay, Boris, can you give that back, please, to Teresa? She's really upset. Go and sit over there, please. Rishi, stop doing that. You know, that was my day to day. I put the notice in, I left. But the thing that I found really interesting is the boys, like, there's this big thing about Andrew Tate. And something the teachers and I were discussing, because there was a big issue with Andrew Tate, and the boys saying these really awful things, like, you know, we know, like, quite an extremism. Andrew Tate is an extremist and he's radicalizing young boys. That's categorically what is happening in schools across the UK and the world. He's incredibly dangerous. But what was happening, these kids have these opinions and they're learning them on the internet and it's affecting their mental health and they don't feel like there's a space for them. Especially a lot of boys, I think, who are, you know, and there's all this language about boys. And I get really angry against the white men jokes that get made in comedy clubs. I'm like, actually, it's probably, I don't think it's helping in the long run. Like, oh, he was obviously a white man, did it? Or he was a bloke, or typical men, or men are this. It's all really problematic because it actually leads to this. I don't know how to, if you immediately, a kid will say an opinion, like, women are this, and you say that is categorically wrong. A kid will go home and say to their dad or their mum or whoever, oh, I said this. And the parents will go, well, you know, this is the woke left gone mad. You can't say anything anymore. And it creates this idea that you can't. And then there's this big divide. And then they speak more and more online in those forums. And you create this sort of incel environment. And we realize the way you combat this is by going, creating a space where these kids can openly talk about what they believe. Horrible, you know, it's... Well, we know about gay people, whatever it is that they've been taught at home or what they've read on the internet from someone that they think is a father figure or a family, you know, the role model they wish they had. And you open their mind by listening to them and questioning them about it and not having a go and not saying they're wrong and not saying they're disgusting or they're stupid or they're thick or whatever it is that people sometimes do say. Or, you know, the way you slam someone on Twitter. If you open that discussion, and they can get it out there and ask them open-ended questions and you challenge the behavior. You say, I think the opinion you're saying is wrong, but you are not wrong. You are a good person, but that opinion comes from this very misinformed place and let's work through that. You create the ability for someone to change and the ability for people to communicate in a far more mentally healthy way, if that makes any sense.
That makes so much sense. I do a lot of that myself in having, you know, difficult conversations. You can imagine with the work that I do that everyone wants to talk to me about their thoughts, both controversial and otherwise. And I've never heard it articulated as clearly as that. I think you're so right. I want to reflect on it, but I'm aware timing-wise, we need to wrap up on our main episode.
Oh, God, yeah.
So thank you so much for this conversation. This is no surprise that when we were going to talk about identity together, we were going to have so much to get into. So in a moment, we'll get back. We'll have a final bit of chat behind the paywall and I'll share some thoughts in return. But for now, if people want to find you, find your work, go see your social media, like a post that isn't a picture of you, where should they go?
So go to www.elflions.com. You can follow me on Instagram at elflions and Twitter on at elflions. And I'm doing a really big show at Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of June, which may seem like ages away, and it is, but I'd like you all to come because I have obsessive compulsive disorder and people are booking tickets in really odd places and it's not symmetrical on the booking form and I'm getting really stressed. So if anyone could book the tickets B12 and B13 to make the B row equal, it would really, really help me.
There you go. A very clear, wonderful call to action. Thank you, Elf.
No worries. Bye.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, You are enough.